Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. This year, LSE is celebrating its 130th anniversary and how it has shaped history and driven change across the world. Much of LSE's history is linked to the United States, from philanthropic support from the U.S. in LSE's early days to famous alumni and American directors of the school. To talk about LSE's long and close relationship with the United States, in October 2025, I spoke to Professor Michael Cox. Professor Cox is a founding director of LSE Ideas, LSE's foreign policy think tank, and was its director between 2008 and 2019. He is also Emeritus Professor of International Relations at LSE and has been writing a history of the school. Our discussion on the LSE-US relationship covered the breadth of LSE's history, from its founding days right up to the present day. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you do too. Well, thanks so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. To set the scene, what does LSE's relationship with the U.S. look like now? How many full-time American students are taking part in summer school, and how many full-time American students are there? How many U.S. alumni chapters are there?
Good question. And that relationship between the LSE and the United States, as I've argued elsewhere and in previous blogs, a very strong one, and probably stronger today than ever. Going on to the question of alumni, I think we've got about 18 chapters in the United States, something along those lines anyway, and they're very active ones. I've spoken at them. So it's probably one of our biggest alumni associations. We have many around the world, of course, but that's certainly one of our most active and I think one of our biggest. The number of students at the LSE, well, there's two types of students, or maybe three. One is students who come to summer school, which is a very successful venture at the LSE. We've got about 6,500 coming to summer school here every year now. And I think something close to 1,000 of those are going to be American students. So there's that group. Then there's regular undergraduate students, our junior year abroad students and others. That runs into the hundreds. And then many who come over to do our one-year master's course, which I think has gained very, very popular. So at the student level, it is quite considerable, and at the alumni level, it's not quite as big as the number of students coming here from, say, China or from India, but nonetheless, it is a significant contribution to the school. And I would argue, too, that Donald Trump may also be a factor in accelerating the number of US students coming here. And we've seen this year alone, across the whole of the UK, but that would also include the LSE, about a 14 to 15% rise in undergraduate students alone applying for British universities. That tells us a lot what's going on in US universities. So in that sense, rather ironically, Trump might be doing us a favor. There are other aspects of the relationship which I think worth noting. We now have a president who is American, to be noted. It's our second American president in 10 years, Larry Kramer, no doubt doing a very good job. We call all of our faculty now professors, which is interesting. It's a kind of an Americanization. We used to be lecturers, senior lecturers, readers. All that's gone. And I think that's a slight Americanization, but I think it's worth noting. So I think all those things are kind of adding up to an increasingly important part of that relationship today with the United States. The one final thing I'd also say, and it has to do a little bit with Brexit. I mean, I know Brexit happened nearly 10 years ago, but it didn't sever our relationship with Europe. It didn't disconnect us from the European Union. It hasn't undermined our reputation in the European Union, but it's made that relationship with Europe and European students that much more problematic. And so again, I think that's probably going to accelerate, reinforce our relationship with the United States without breaking the relationship with the European Union or European University. I think that is going to add, not to the Americanization of the LSE, but to make that relationship even stronger today than it was, say, 10 or 20 years ago.
Thank you. And could you just maybe talk a bit more about why LSE has been attractive historically to American students, maybe more recently? I know you've already talked about the Trump factor, but say, given that they are not spoiled for choice to study at their own home institutions in the US.
One, let's be perfectly honest, it is the London School of Economics. So London is a pull. And the argument always was, rather tongue in cheek, was they came to London so they could then go on holiday to Europe. But I think the London fact is key. People like being in London. Secondly, on the more academic side, it's a concentrated school of social sciences and economics. And I think that has been attractive. It's the ecosystem, which is the London School of Economics and Political Science. So we don't get students coming here to study English or Latin or engineering or medicine. And I think, again, for those who are interested in social sciences, in international relations, in economics, anthropology, all the big departments we've got here make it a very, very attractive option for Americans. And then, let's be blunt, there is a kind of special relationship between the UK and the United States. And that translates into a kind of special relationship too with the LSE. We speak the same language. I think we call it English, American English or English English. It's still English. The UK, for all of its faults, still has high positive recognition in the United States more generally, not just amongst liberals or on the left, but also amongst conservatives. And I think that also adds to the attractiveness of the LSE as well. That doesn't mean to say that other universities in the UK are not attractive. Interestingly, Oxford, of course, is. And interestingly, too, I discovered St. Andrews up in Scotland has a special attraction for American students as well. So I'm not making the LSE unique, but it clearly does pretty well in that American environment.
So you talked about LSE as a social science university. What would you say the state of studies about the US or on the US is at LSE at the moment?
Well, first thing I've got to say, Chris, I'm sitting in the US Phelan Center, and that didn't exist when I came to the LSE in 2003. It exists now under the direction of my good friend, Pete Trubovitz. So we've got a big, well-established US center, which I'm totally in favor of. It gives a focus for US studies. There is also around the school quite a lot of people who kind of teach about the US, whether US economic history, American history. The International History Department does quite a lot. I know the International Relations Department does quite a lot. I'd also say one other thing, which I noticed the other day when I was going through our list of LSE Nobel Prizes in economics. There have individuals who've been awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics from the LSE who didn't have an American connection, but not many. Quite interesting. They either have studied at the LSE and gone to American universities or come from American universities and spent a little time here and then got there. So I looked down through the list, and I think there's about 16 or 17 Nobel Prizes in Economics. And I'd say probably the 80% of them have a kind of connection to the LSE or have worked with American colleagues as well. So there's another interesting connection as well.
So we've talked a bit about where LSE is now in terms of its relationship with the US. But I guess the question is, how did we get here? What is the history of the US and LSE?
Well, this brings out my bias to history, as you know, Chris. I love the history of the LSE, and I've been trying to write it for the last 5 or 6 years, of course. It's quite interesting. The first country that Beatrice and Sidney Webb, two of our founders, first country they visited together in 1898, this was 3 years after the school had been founded, was none other than the United States. And the question is why? I think there were pretty clear reasons, and you can see them in the letters between Sidney and Beatrice Webb. One reason was quite clear. They knew America was a rising power. Economically, culturally, they saw connections with the United States for the obvious reasons. I think they realized if the LSE was to become a truly global institution, which it has become, then it could not become a global institution with global reach, claim globality, though nobody used that term at the time, without a strong connection with the United States. There was a big problem, however, in 1898, which Sidney, of course, solved, as he solved most problems around the LSE at the time. Namely, we weren't giving degrees, and we only started giving degrees at the LSE by 1901, when we became an affiliate member of the University of London. And Sidney said very clearly then, and in one letter to Beatrice Webb, his wife, said, look, until we can give students from the United States degrees, they're not going to come here. Where were students from the United States going at the time? Interestingly, people forget this, it was Germany, because it was the German model of higher education, which in a sense had been taken over in the United States. And so although there was a linguistic maybe difference, because English being the national language in the United States, nonetheless, they looked to Germany. And Sidney again was quite explicit. He said, if we want to bring students to the UK, to London, then we've got to offer them degrees, and we've got to make sure that then they may want to still go to Germany, but they'll stop off at the LSE en route to going to Germany. I don't know what the numbers were. They weren't that great. He saw it, therefore, in terms of the growing rivalry between Great Britain, the Empire, and Germany. Although he was a great admirer of the German higher education system, he knew that the Germans actually did something rather well and that we needed to do it even better, especially at the LSE. And he thought the kinds of subjects that were going to be taught at the LSE, like banking, trade, commerce, anthropology, sociology, all those things would be very, very attractive to a certain group of American students. So that was another aspect to it. And again, Sidney Webb was a very sharp cookie, you know, and he kind of understood that in the end, without an input from the United States, whether it was financial support or bringing students over, then the LSE would never fully develop as a truly global institution. I think he was very shrewd on it. And I think, again, just to repeat the point, the fact that they both went to the United States in 1898 together is significant. The two other points I'd also point out, and there's some very funny stories come out of their letters, which I might as well relate to you now because they are quite funny. They didn't like American cities. They thought Pittsburgh was appalling. And by the way, after that, they never liked Andrew Carnegie very much because of the Pittsburgh connection. They thought Chicago was appalling. The one city that Beatrice Webb liked more than any other, and you'll never believe this, but it's true, was Salt Lake City. She's a bit of an admirer of the Mormons because they seemed to be very well organized. Their streets were clean. This is a very Sidney and Beatrice Webb view of the world. They admired Woodrow Wilson. They thought he was a fine guy. And they admired a number of people. They also admired one particular institution in the United States, not the Ivy Leagues. They would never quite take it. They said Yale was very provincial. But the one they did really like was MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And the reason for that was because they did applied research. It was research which was useful for taking research-based policy. That's what they were looking for at the LSE. And when they looked around US universities, not all of them did it. Princeton didn't do it. Harvard didn't do it. Yale didn't. MIT did it. And also to a certain degree, Columbia University. And so they were also trying to learn from what they thought was best practice in the United States as well.
So how did the relationship between LSE and the US evolve after World War I? And how important was the Rockefeller Foundation for the school?
Well, I've always argued that you've got to understand the relationship between the LSE and British universities in the United States in that larger global context. And the fact of the matter is, in the 20th century, Britain and the United States found itself on the same side in two hot wars, First World War and the Second, and of course in the Cold War. And inevitably, that made that alliance very strong. It made for that thing we call the special relationship, bit by bit. Not straight away, but it happened. It therefore created within the United States a kind of a friendly attitude towards the United Kingdom generally, and towards their allies, both in the First World War, and then even more so, I think, in the Second World War and during the Cold War. And I think that made London, the UK, far more attractive. And of course, then there were those other advantages, like language as well. Quite a large number of American servicemen who were stationed in the UK, both at the end of the First World War, and also even more so at the end of the Second World War. Some of them even came here to do courses, you know, short-term courses. That's also very, very, very interesting part of the story as well. I think also that you mentioned the Rockefeller, and this is a very interesting part of the relationship. As we know, the Rockefellers were very keen to develop social sciences in Europe. So they dispersed quite a lot of grants right across Europe, both to Germany, to Austria, I think to France, but also to the LSE. And it was through something called the Laura Spelman Foundation. And in the end, between 1921, 22, 23, and towards the end of the 1930s, it accounted, and I can't do exact figures on this, but it accounted for something like 20 to 25% of our budget. So it was quite a significant amount. Now, the interesting thing is, and I've just come across this, Chris, on the issue of the Rockefellers. And it was very important. I've been through the archives on this. It's very interesting to see some at the LSE, more British, if you like, kind of resented this. Like, oh, well, you know, why are we taking this money from the Americans, from the Yanks? You know, they think they can buy anything. On the other hand, I noticed there weren't too many academics who turned down a research grant coming through the Rockefeller Foundation, the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Foundation. But the then director, of course, William Beveridge, he was very shrewd again. He basically refounded the school, I think. Two foundings of the school, one in 1895, and the second one came about, I think, under the direction of William Beveridge between 1919 and 1937. And Beveridge knew a good thing when he saw it, and he knew that this relationship was there. He knew that people administering the Rockefeller Foundation money were keen on the LSE as a social science university. Social sciences had exploded in the United States during World War I because you had to understand attitudes. You had to understand popular views. You had to kind of know what the people are thinking, and that was a good
way of social science being practical and useful. And so they looked around the social science universities around Europe and in the UK, and they found and obviously discovered the LSE. But there's a wonderful little story which William Beveridge tells, and it says a lot about William Beveridge. And it tells you a lot about how important the Rockefeller money was. He says, I've got to go off to the United States. This is 1923, 1924. I've got to go off to the United States. Really, the reason I really want to go is because I want to go and meet the people from the Rockefeller Foundation. I need £7,000. He actually says this in his little memoirs, one of his memoirs. He did many. And he said, why do I need it? Now, was it to kind of corrupt the academics at LSE, buy them off so they all become pro-capitalist? No, no. He wanted it because he needed money to knock down Houghton Street. Most people don't know this story. Houghton Street was a series of slums, little slum shops all the way down Houghton Street when the traffic used to go down there. And they need to get that old part of Houghton Street, which is now different, of course, today, simply knocked down so they could start building there buildings for the LSE. So he said, I've got some money from the London County Council, but I do need money, an extra £7,000 from the Rockefeller Foundation in order to knock it down. And he got the money. And, you know, he came back. And of course, it was an important part of the LSE at that time. So it wasn't just doing the research work, although a lot of money did go to research. And a lot of academics who may have been a bit snooty towards the Rockefeller always seemed to accept the money from the Rockefeller, as far as I could see. But it was also very important in terms of building an infrastructure at the school itself. And again, to get back to the original question, there's no question that the Rockefeller money wasn't the only money. Lots of other money was coming in, particularly from students and from other sources. But the Rockefeller was very, very important. And indeed, in the end, it was a phrase used by William Beveridge's wife-to-be, Janet Mayer, who became Janet Beveridge when they got married, said that LSE had become Rockefeller's baby. I think that overdid it, but nonetheless, that was very, very important. One final point here, just to add, of course, who came to study at the LSE in the middle, late 30s was, of course, none other than David Rockefeller. He spent a year in the economics department, but far from it being a left-wing department, the economics department was very pro-market, free market. Lionel Robbins, von Hayek, a number of others. And he said it was great being here at that time. When the school had this reputation of being very left-wing, David Rockefeller was studying in the economics department, which was hardly left-wing.
Thank you. And thinking about other well-known folks who came to the school around that time, I believe John F. Kennedy was also enrolled to be a student here.
This is a very interesting story. As you know, Joe Kennedy Sr., very famous Irish-American, made a lot of money in certain ways. He was a good Irishman, and he wasn't the greatest fan, you know, of the British Empire. But nonetheless, he had contributed quite substantially to Franklin Roosevelt's battle chest and the New Deal. He's a big New Dealer, of course, Joe Kennedy Sr. And he wanted his two boys to come here, at least the two boys to come here. There was Joe Kennedy Sr., who did come here and studied for a year. And he wanted the younger Kennedy, John F. Fitzgerald, to come and study here. Now, we know that John F. Kennedy enrolled at the school, but as I think somebody once said to me, he's the most famous alumnus we never had, because John F. Kennedy apparently was ill. I think there's long-term problems with his back. And so he had to go back to the United States. What was also interesting about that period, of course, was Joe Kennedy Sr. wanted them to come and study here because there was a particular lecturer here at the LSE, a professor at the LSE in the 1930s, who was on the left, Harold Laski. And Harold Laski, by the way, and it's often not written out, but it's not given enough credence. He had an enormous reputation in the United States, particularly in the 1930s during the period of the New Deal. He knew Oliver Wendell Holmes. He was constantly writing to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Dear Franklin. And Kennedy knew that Laski was known as the best lecturer in the school, though on the left, obviously, not Kennedy's politics. He said, go and study under Laski and find out what's going on in Europe, and then you'll have a better appreciation of world politics. But I think it was a very shrewd idea, you know. But again, if we're talking about influence in the LSE with the United States, there's always been that current of opinion at the LSE, not always, and not maybe the majority, but it's been on the left. There was Laski in the 1930s who exerted quite a pull on American public opinion. He was actually very pro-American. He was very pro-New Deal. And he was very pro-Roosevelt. He's constantly giving Roosevelt advice. Typical Harold Laski, I have to say. And then, of course, in the 1960s, pushing the narrative forward. One of the things about the troubles, the so-called troubles here in LSE during the period of student revolt, as it was called, the authorities here, particularly Lionel Robbins, one of the great figures of the school, actually thought that all the agitation that was coming to the school was largely coming from all these American students who had come out of Berkeley, out of the students of Democratic democratic society. So there's been another dimension to the relationship, not only academic or students in general, but certain intellectual currents as well. And Lasky represents one of them. And this view that somehow or another, all the troubles here in the 90s were created by these wretched American radicals coming over from the Students for Democratic Society and stirring up trouble here. I think that was a great simplification. But again, it's another part of that relationship which needs to be written into the history.
So how more generally did the broader relationship that existed between the US and the UK through both the Second World War and the Cold War help to bolster the appeal of LSE back in the US?
Well, I mean, it just that I get back to a point I made earlier on, Chris. Britain's standing amongst Americans after the Second World War and going into the Cold War was very high. Classic alliance. They liked Winston Churchill. Surprise, surprise. Many of them had worked with the Labour government between 45 and 51 under Clement Attlee. Clement Attlee understood that Britain had to have a very close relationship with the United States for security and on nuclear weapons and everything else. Also worth noting that quite a lot of the Americans who came here in the 1950s and 60s enjoyed being at the LSE. It was London. It was social science. It was different. There was quite a number who came through at the time. One of the most famous was Senator Moynihan. He came here, I think, in the 50s and 60s. He thought it was a terribly left-wing place. I'm not sure it was, but he thought it was a terribly left-wing place to what he had left behind in the United States. But he found that very, very interesting indeed. Later on, by the way, Moynihan, who became US ambassador to the UN, I think also to India, later pointed out that all these third world revolutions and these third world kind of socialist regimes, they'd all been born, not in Moscow, but at the London School of Economics. Anthony Kennedy, who later was in the Supreme Court, very important swing vote in the Supreme Court, he studied here in that period. And one other I always like mentioning, of course, although he was Hungarian and Jewish, came from Hungary, through Hungary, was, of course, George Soros. And George Soros, this is a fascinating story, I find. George Soros came here as a young and inexperienced and a penniless Hungarian refugee first from Nazism and then from Stalinism. He studied under Karl Popper, the famous philosopher who started working here in 1945 and 1946, became the most famous philosopher in the world almost, Popper at the LSE. And Popper's philosophy, without going into too much detail, his philosophy was one of constantly testing theory against reality. And I don't want to oversimplify it, but Soros learned a lot from Popper philosophically. And he said, what I then did was apply some of Popper's theories of knowledge, uncertainty, to my own financial dealings. He actually later said that probably I made all the money I made because I followed Popper. So therein again is a kind of an interesting connection with the other. And there were a number of others here. Robert Hunter, who later became, was in the IR department, later became American ambassador to NATO. We got a large numbers of other, Janet Napolitano studied here. And of course, a large number of others, Janet Yellen, who later went on, studied here as an economist. So, you know, the connections went on and on and on. There was always a steady stream coming through. In the 30s and the 20s, overwhelming numbers of overseas students had tended to be from the British Empire, to be honest. You know, that's where they had come from, largely from the Raj, from India, not only, but that's where they came. Many also came from Germany and from Asia as well, from China and Japan. After the war, I tended to think, I need to check this up, but after the war, I think the numbers of Americans became greater. It was just an easier place to go and work in. The only complaint that most American students had was the weather, was the food, and of course, always the plumbing was always complained about. And then we had the junior year abroad, come and study for 1 year. And then, of course, much later, the LSE, I think very wisely, introduced their one-year master's. So that gave American students, you didn't have to study for 2 years as you did for an American master. You could study for 1 year here. And it would carry cachet back in the United States.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary. And if you're lucky, you might win £250 in vouchers.
So moving forward in time a bit now, what was LSE's influence on the third way in an age of globalization during the 1990s?
This is, again, a fascinating part of the relationship. Tony Giddens, of course, became director in 1996, was it? Tony Blair was elected prime minister here in, 1997, the new Labour. And Bill Clinton spoke here on two, maybe three occasions at that time. And I've always thought that Tony Giddens relaunched the LSE in some ways intellectually. That's my own take on it. I'm a very great fan of Tony Giddens because he was the world's most famous sociologist at the time. And of course, they developed this notion of a third way, that the end of the Cold War had rendered communism, full-scale five-year planned socialism, irrelevant. On the other hand, you didn't want to move over to a full market economy of the kind advocated by someone like Hayek or Milton Friedman. So you kind of went down the middle. That's the third way. Neither full-scale market, neither full-scale socialism. And in a way, intellectually, I think much of that was theorized and developed. Yeah. Others contributed to it. It's a kind of late 20th century social democracy. You don't go for nationalization, but you do go for some redistribution. But you also accept, and I think this was true both of Clinton and of Tony Blair, and it was certainly true, I think, of Tony Giddens, that somehow or another, globalization was inevitable. Bill Clinton once referred to it as like running water running down a hill, like gravity. You could moan about it, you could groan about it, you could complain about it. You needed to take measures to offset some of the downside disadvantages of globalization, like retraining and all the rest. And education was a very important part of that as well, too, by the way. But nonetheless, it wasn't something you could stop. And I think that also brought together Clinton in that particular period, in that 1990s period. Again, I think for students today, it seems like a long, long way away, a long time ago, but I remember it very well. This kind of optimism, a liberal optimism, not a socialist optimism, not a free market optimism, but a liberal optimism about the management of a world which would be both fairer, more just, multilateral. Institutions would play a big role, but you'd accept that the ultimate logic was being driven by a globalization which would raise all boats together and would actually make the world a more peaceful and more stable place. Of course, today the debate about globalization is a somewhat different one, as we know.
So how has LSE's relationship with the US deepened over the last quarter century, and why?
I make the point, I'm slightly tongue-in-cheek, everybody now at the LSE is a professor. In the old days, you know, British universities used to have strange titles like lecturer, senior lecturer, reader. And I think that's a kind of an Americanization, I suppose. I always joke with Larry Kramer, we used to have a director, now we've got a president. So, I mean, maybe these are purely symbolic. I think we also need to, you know, put it in balance and put it in perspective. We know that the LSE has about 13,000 students. 2,300 of those come from mainland China. 450, 500 come from Hong Kong. Very good number come from Southeast Asia, particularly the English-speaking countries of Southeast Asia like Singapore and Malaysia. So we want to put it in perspective. But nonetheless, that US component, I think, really remains very, 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 very important indeed. And I think also the United States also confers a kind of prestige and status. Let's be honest. Not everybody would agree with me on that. But what I mean by that is this, that if we're honest about it, and I think we need to be and face the fact, still, the United States has an ecosystem of higher education, which is second to none in the world. Now, whether it's going to be undermined by the current president, we'll have to wait and see. He's not doing much to help it and its international reputation. But nonetheless, if you take the top 100 universities around the world and how are they regarded in terms of their status, in terms of their research output, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay, Oxbridge does well, LSE does okay, King's College does okay, Zurich does quite well. You know, there are others who do quite well. Increasing large numbers from Asia do quite well. Nonetheless, if you look at the top 100, something like 60 of those are US. And that's because A, there's a lot of money. B, they've been around a long time. Harvard, after all, goes back to what, 1690. My old college of William and Mary goes back to what, 1692. These are pretty old and well-established universities. There's a lot of money and it's very, very attractive. And it therefore generates a level of research. And I think that makes, I make this point with some guardedness because it might offend others, but I make it anyway, that in a sense, the US has set the gold standard. I mean, it was once said of international relations that it has become an American social science. Well, is this true for economics? I looked the other day at the top 10 journals in which you get published, which have the highest citation. Guess where? Most of them, not all, but many of them are based in the US. And that again confers the status and the prestige. And I even had a conversation the other day with somebody I won't mention. I said, which conferences do you tend to go to? Do you want to go to conferences on the continent? I said, sometimes maybe, clearly, if you're doing European studies and other things like that. Nothing wrong. Some great universities in Germany, France, and Scandinavian countries. Wonderful universities in Italy, of course. Nonetheless, the pull of the United States still remains very, very high for students going to conferences where you'd like to publish. So that again strengthens that relationship. relationship. And go back to the old thing about the special relationship. It's just easier in many ways. Not all of us are very fluent in different foreign languages. I can manage a bit of Russian and quite a lot of French. But let's be honest, most people find it easier speaking a language which other people speak, which is the English language. And given the power and the strength and the size of the what I call the American academic ecosystem, that again has an enormous pull, I think, not only on the LSE, but quite a lot of other institutions, and not just institutions too in the UK, but also across the channel in Europe.
Going back to the topic we were looking at the beginning of this conversation, what impact has Brexit and Trump's second administration had on LSE and its relationship with the US?
Well, it is a leading question, Chris. Well, let's be perfectly honest. I was in and around the LSE a lot of the time in June 2016. And I was in and around the LSE a lot of the time in November 2016. One was Brexit, of course, and first November was Trump. It was very negatively perceived, and understandably so, because one of the consequences, apart from that image of the UK in Europe, and indeed around the world, I'd say, was that European Union students, and we've been a member of the European Union, now had to pay overseas fees. Now, I don't know the full figures of how that's impacted on how EU students, whether we get as many as we used to, but I somehow doubt we do. So we had a nice, easy, natural relationship with students coming from the EU, of which the UK was then a member. We're no longer a member. So I think that impacted negatively, no doubt about it, and still does. You know, I teach in Italy a lot. I've taught in Spain and France and other universities across the European Union, and there's no point denying it. The impact there has been a very negative one. Not negative about the LSE, but about the UK in general. And of course, more practical reasons. EU students now have to pay the full amount of money. They can't just be treated as a home student. So that's clearly changed to the detriment, I'll be perfectly honest, of the UK and LSE. My own take on it. I know there's still a large, fair number of EU students who come here, but nonetheless, I'm pretty certain it's not disastrous, but it's been negative. The Trump factor, of course, is a very interesting one. Trump has been good for business in the sense that because he's so radical and because he's so volatile and because he's so novel and because he doesn't do what previous presidents have done, whether Republican or Democrat have done, either at home or abroad, even G.W. Bush, probably more in common with Barack Obama than does G.W. Bush with Trump 2.0. Because of this, interest in the United States has never been higher. If Biden had won again, I'm sure people would still be interested in the United States. But Biden wasn't a radical. Biden was a middle-of-the-road guy who followed all the basics of standard U.S. foreign policy on multilateralism, etc. But along comes this storm called Donald Trump. It's a storm on tariffs, withdrawing from this treaty and that treaty, making very rude speeches at the UN, attacking the UN, telling all the Europeans that they're going to hell politically and economically, trying to do a deal with Putin, essentially trying to throw Ukraine under a bus. Doesn't know whether he wants to or not, but that's the impression. Pulling out of all the aid programs. All of that has created a shockwave across Europe, and no more so, I think, that in the UK and also here. But the net effect of all this, actually, ironic, is to make interest, make the focus on the United States even greater. I don't know about you, Chris, but I've never lived in a moment in time, and I've lived through quite a few, even going back to the Vietnam War, and when there was great interest in the US, obviously, because of foreign policy. There was great interest under Ronald Reagan. There was great interest, actually, under G.W. Bush, though for all negative reasons, because of the war on terror and opposition to it and the invasion of Iraq. But I've never known a moment in time when there's been so much obsession to the point of fixation on the United States and on one individual figure within the United States called Donald Trump. Everybody needs to know now about America more than ever. We need more than ever good analysis. How did we arrive here? Why did 77 million people vote for Trump? Got to answer that question. Is there something profound going on inside the United States which has brought us Trump or Trumpism? Does this tell us a lot about polarization in the United States? Sort of things that I know Peter Trubovitz has written about for many years so well. What does this tell us about the future of the world if the United States is taking an entirely different tack towards the world, not only towards Russia, towards the EU, towards NATO, towards trade, towards multilateralism? What does that mean fighting for the international order. And in a way, here at the LSE, and I think certainly through the US Phelan Center, amongst others, you are the guys with the concentrated kind of expertise and knowledge. It puts on us an enormous responsibility, I think, really a big responsibility to try and understand this. As you say, the LSE, we're always trying to understand the deeper causes of things. And I think this is the moment when we've got to do it. And I know the Phelan Center's doing that. And I think there's many others around it. What we've got to do as intellectuals, public intellectuals, and particularly in an important place like the LSE, which carries a voice carries around the world, let's be honest, we know it does. We've got to provide deep analysis, real understanding. How is it we've arrived here? We started with Clinton in the 1990s, the liberal moment, the unipolar moment when globalization and markets and democracy promotion was going to push all before it. I partly believed that myself at the time. I even wrote a book on American democracy promotion with my good friend John Eikenberry and Takashi Yanaguchi back in 2000. How have we arrived from that to where we are today? And secondly, is this going to have a long-term, deep, profound effect on both the United States and the world? And those are the two key questions we've really got to address.
We've talked quite a lot about how LSE has shaped the US through alumni and intellectually in that way. Has it been a two-way street at all? Has the US shaped LSE's intellectual history or the kind of work that's being done here?
Well, I think so. I think, again, we have a US center now, which we didn't have before. Economics, which is, I'm not an economist, as you know, but a lot of economics is done a lot across a lot of American economics departments. And what starts in America tends to spread around the world. I mean, we talk about the Washington Consensus, don't we? We talk about development of neoliberal economics, and many would say that started at Chicago with Milton Friedman, although some would even say it may have even begun at the LSE with Hayek, of course, much earlier. There's the influence of ideas that come across the Atlantic. Some would even say, and again, I move into kind of onto thinner ice here, some would even say that the whole logic of what is now called woke ideology, although it's a broader Western phenomenon, whatever you understand that to mean, and it's so difficult to understand what people do mean when they attack it. Nonetheless, the kind of notion that something's been going on inside the United States amongst progressives, and it's kind of translated itself and come across the Atlantic and is doing major damage to British universities, including the LSE, I'm told. I'm not sure I agree with that. But nonetheless, all it tells us is that if your economy is 25% of the world economy, if you've got more universities than you know what to do with, you've got a country of, what, 330, 40 million people. You take in more Chinese students than any other part of the world, even today. That's the United States, US colleges. The impact, or what I call this hegemon, if that's the right word, or behemoth, or this superpower, it still exerts it. I've had long discussions at the LSE over many years about, is the United States in decline or not? Generally tended to the strong view that I don't think it is. I think it had major crises at certain moments. I think it's had major problems. It faces serious, deep problems today, I think, of polarization. But nonetheless, when you measure it against capabilities, its own capabilities, then this is still a country which exerts enormous influence on the rest of the world. Trump proves how much power the United States still has. We wouldn't be talking about him as much as we tend to. I know we talk about China, and we'll talk about India, and we'll talk about the European Union and Latin America, Africa. But nonetheless, I don't know about you, but I can't remember a time when we've ever talked about the United States so regularly and so obsessively, which tells us a lot about the power of the United States still. And I think that's really the key to the whole question. It's less about universities exerting influence, but the United States exerting an influence, whether for good or for bad.
So you've been looking at the history of LSE for quite some time. Does the recent history of the school's relationship with the US that we've been talking about give you any new insights into the school's wider history?
I'll just give one simple answer to that. I'm an historian of the school and devoted historian to the school. I just need to get the book out, of course. But I've been struck all the way along that while the school has always had a global reputation and has always attracted students from many parts of the world, including especially in the interwar period from the British Empire, and indeed increasingly now from Asia, the Asian century is supposed to be the 21st century, is it not? I'm always struck by the continuity of the relationship. Go back to Beatrice and Sidney Webb back in 1898, doing their tour of the United States. Why go to the United States first? It wasn't that they didn't like other countries. In fact, as we know later in the 1930s, they got to like the Soviet Union quite a lot, maybe too much, I think. And they were linguists. They understood French and German. But nonetheless, it was the United States which was the draw. What can you learn from it? How many students can we attract from it? How much money can we get from it as well? Let's be perfectly honest. I mean, the LSE was almost failed by 1897, 18. Sidney Webb once said, well, I think we could go under. Anyway, we did our best. And it was a very odd adventure, as Beatrice Webb called it. And I think that's the point I'd make, that time and again, the LSE has turned to the United States. They did it in 1898. They didn't get very much money, but they opened up Corridor. And the Webbs were very well known in the United States, in the same way that Harold Lasky became very well known in the United States. I go even further forward. Von Hayek, who I mentioned earlier on, the great Austrian economist, free market economist, how did he become very famous? Was it because he was a professor here of economics after 1930? No, he was famous here, to be sure. But what made him famous was when they serialized his book, The Road to Serfdom, published in, 1944. They serialized it in the United States in Reader's Digest. And suddenly, Hayek had been an interesting economist, free market, very anti-Keynes, very anti-John Maynard Keynes, which didn't make him very popular in the economics profession then. It's Reader's Digest that popularizes Hayek's complicated thinking in The Road to Serfdom, that anti-collectivist track. So we mentioned earlier on the Rockefeller connection. Numbers of American academics have come to study here. Again, I mentioned it before, but it's worth mentioning. Most of our well-deserved Nobel Prizes in economics, which started to get awarded after 1972, have generally been to academics who were either American or came to study at the LSE or studied at the LSE and went back to the United States. So again, it's that great attractive pull of the United States. And I think that is the continuity, and that's what continues today.
So as LSE turns 130, the US is about to celebrate its own important anniversary, its 250th anniversary next year in 2026. How do you see the US at 250? And how can LSE help shape its future?
Well, I always say, you know, never interfere into the internal affairs of another state. If you remember, Barack Obama came over here just before the Brexit vote and told the British, you'll go to the back of the queue. And it didn't go down terribly well with some people. In fact, they did. Britain did go to the back of the queue, as it turned out, but that's another question. So how could the LSE shape it? I think the way the LSE shapes the United States, and we've got to be modest about what we can and cannot do, let's be perfectly honest. And of course, we have other highly prestigious UK institutions like Oxbridge and St. Andrews. I get back to St. Andrews, dear old St. Andrews. I think the best way we can shape it is by just, as an institution, is by being great teachers and doing great research. That's what universities are about, doing great teaching and great research. In fact, I'll bring you back to one little anecdote story. And this again brings me back to dear old Sidney Webb. After all, he died nearly 80 years ago now, but I'm still talking about him. Sidney Webb said, one of the things we do at the LSE very well, and he's talking about 1898, yeah? We're very good with students. You know, the student experience, which we talk about a lot now. And I pointed out to my American colleagues, some of whom hadn't even heard of the LSE at this stage. They'd heard of Oxbridge and everything. They'd heard of a lot of the great German universities like Charlottenburg and Berlin and all the others. He said, what we do at the LSE, and he pushed this very hard with the Americans. He said, we really look after our students. The student experience is good. We talk to them. We have small seminars. He said, and that's not what they do in Germany. Kind of interesting. Looking after your students, teaching them well, nurturing them. And I think that's quite an interesting observation because today, of course, and quite rightly so, students are, they're the people who pay our bills in the end. They're the ones who pay our wage. Let's be perfectly honest. I mean, we don't have huge endowments. Students, therefore, don't have to be mollycoddled, but they do have to be looked after. And I think the school has actually, over the last few years, done a much better job. I mean, I don't want to criticize anybody in the past, but I think making sure that the student experience is a positive one is very, very important. It's quite interesting, isn't it, that Sidney Webb recognized that back even in 1898 when he said, why they should come to the LSE is because they would have a very good student experience. We'd look after them. We'd do seminars. We'd do a kind of a lot of nurturing. You know, they come to one-to-one or one-to-two or three-or-four seminar. In other words, we're good teachers, but we provide a good supportive environment. And they don't do it in Germany, he said. Now, whether he's being unfair on Germany, I don't know, but that was the point. And I think that's an interesting kind of line of continuity to think about as well.
Thank you. And I think that's a great place for us to finish. But before we do finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Okay, Chris, well, this is my moment to plug the fourth edition of a co-edited book on US foreign policy. I brought out the first edition, I think, in 2012.
Second edition, I think, came out in, if I remember, 2018. I think there was a third edition about 3 years ago now. And in 2026, I'm bringing out a co-edited book on US foreign policy. It's done very well both over here in Australia and in the United States. We have a very large number of great American writers in there. I mentioned two or three here. John Eikenberry's in there. Chris Lane is in there. A famous academic at the LSE called Peter Trubovitz has a chapter in there. We've got 10 new chapters in there. We've got on US and India, US and the military. So I'm very happy with this. Because I think, frankly, academics need to write not only for other academics, but also for students. You know, it's the students, you know, are the lifeblood of universities. I've always believed that. And always wanted that particular textbook, whatever you want to call it, to be something that students would read and use. I think they will, because it's done quite well. We're out with the fourth edition. It'll be out in 2026. It's got a very nice cover, and it's got some great essays in there, not only by Americans, but by others as well. I hope that does very well. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to plug it.
Well, our listeners should definitely look out for that. Just remains for me to say, Professor Michael Cox, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
Thank you, Chris.
Professor Michael Cox is a founding director of LSE Ideas and also Emeritus Professor of International Relations at LSE. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Michael Cox for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/United-States. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswags.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It really helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.